You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, October 2nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Professor James Galbraith, Lloyd Benson Chair in Government, the School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, on his new book, The End of Normal. Also on the program today, big but maybe short-lived victory in voting in North Carolina. Also, good job, Chris Christie. Amtrak is going to be shutting down four of the tunnels leading into Manhattan over the next couple of years to repair damage done by Hurricane Sandy. And if you're coming from New Jersey, welcome to your biggest nightmare. Also on the program today, perhaps the sine qua non of ridiculous Republican ads attempting to appeal to young women who, you know, only can relate to picking out a wedding dress. Meanwhile, a study shows long-term birth control methods decreases rates of pregnancy and abortions dramatically. Head of the Secret Service has left to spend more time protecting her family. And Dr. Ben Carson has an interesting perspective on history. Let's just leave it there. Oh, yeah, and we also...
some interpretation.
Yes. We will actually today on the program do an interpretation of what would happen if George Washington came back to talk to Dr. Ben Carson about his perspective on history. I think you'll find that all quite enjoyable in the event that we can be as funny with it as we were for the past hour and a half in the
office.
How
many times does the real comedic gems happen in show prep
indeed,
and then just completely fall flat on air?
Many, many times indeed. Folks, you can support this program. In fact, we need your support. This program relies on members' support for 99.9% of its income and revenue, I should say. And you can do that by becoming a member today at majority.fm. Look, I know you hear this every day, and you're like, I've been meaning to do it, but what about Today's the day. Today is the day for you, sir and lady, to become a member of the Majority Report. Again, if you cannot afford to become a member and really want the better half, then send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and we will take care of you. But if you do have the financial means to support this program, even if only you listen to to the first half, or maybe you'll find, you know what, I actually like the second half better, and I only listen to that. Become a member today at majority.fm. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, you can support this program if you buy crap from Amazon at majorityreportkickback.com and justcoffee.coop. It's a employee-owned company out of Madison, Wisconsin. They gave coffee to the folks who were protesting back in the day. They give fair trade. They give fair wages to everybody in their supply chain. Great coffee, great tea, great chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, James Galbraith. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Lloyd Benson, Chair in Government and Business Relations at the School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, and the author of his latest, The End of Normal, James Galbraith. James, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much.
So let's start with what was or many have considered normal. You break down the sort of the normal period in terms of the way our economy works, or the way normal as it was perceived between World War II and 2000, and then you break it down between two different periods there. From World War II to 1970, tell us what happened in that period, and then we'll get to why it's misperceived as being normal.
Okay. Well, first of all, for your listener's sake, this is all about the process of economic growth and what is to be expected for the future. And my argument is that our notions of the future are framed by our experience in the past. And we tend to think of the whole post-war period running right up at least to 2000, maybe up to 2007, as one continuous process of economic growth, which is not a bad approximation if you're just focused narrowly on the experience of the United States and the other wealthy countries, but it conceals really major differences for the world as a whole. The big difference the big dividing point I would say is in the 1970s. First period after the post-war, after the Second World War, was a period of generally stable growth all around the world, very inexpensive resources, and a kind of military and political stability contributed by the Cold War and the U.S. position as the major victor of World War II. That was interrupted in the 1970s, and when growth resumed in the rich countries in the 1980s, it didn't resume anywhere else, or at least it didn't resume in large parts of the world, for which the 80s and the 90s were periods of a rolling crises. And so I would argue that already by the 1970s, global conditions had changed, and we were living, if we thought we were living in a projection of the earlier period, we were deluding ourselves. So that's the key part of the argument. And an implication of it is that after 2000, things really did change, even for us, and the situation has become substantially more difficult, and we ought to be taking that into account.
All right. So let's talk about what was it that so in the 70s we had this sort of interruption of maybe, I don't know if delusion is.
Well, we had a major shock to energy costs, which stemmed from the fact that we were no longer able to supply our needs from our own territory. The locus of oil, in particular, moved to the Middle East, and we were vulnerable to to the political upheavals in that region and to their power over the price. So we experienced that. But then in the 1980s, energy prices came, commodity prices came back down again, and we resumed a path of economic growth that started in 1984 and continued right up to through the end of the Clinton administration in 2000. So we began to get the idea that we had solved the problem that had plagued us in the 1970s and returned to this earlier path. This was called by economists the Great Moderation, and I call it the Great Illusion.
And during the course of this time, because it seems that starting in 1980, while we had this continuous growth that may have been, as you say, a delusion, it was far more uneven than it was in the period that preceded it,
it was growth that favored the wealthy over and disadvantaged working people to a very, very substantial extent, and that was true inside the United States, and it was true between the rich countries and the poorer countries. Very clear in the data. So you had it was a different, very different period from the standpoint of the people at the bottom of the ladder, who maybe in the rich countries were living in economies that were experiencing growth, but to a very large extent they weren't experiencing it personally.
And were the reasons why starting in 80 or so that the growth became uneven or shared more evenly shared, Were the reasons for that in the United States similar to that of other countries?
Yes, I think so. The growth process after 1980 was largely driven by credit expansions. And in the U.S., that was in the 80s, there was the savings and loans. And then in the 90s, there was information technology boom. And all through this period, culminating in the 2000s, there was the buildup of the mortgage finance bubble and debacle. So all of these things were credit cycles, which have a rhythm of their own. They rise and then they fall. The earlier period was much more balanced. You had growth of public spending, you had growth of wages, you had unionized industries that were growing in a reasonably stable way. So all of that meant that the overall the economy was growing on a more balanced basis, and on a basis that was therefore had more inertia, more momentum than the later period did.
So there's two. I mean, just to not to belabor this too much, but there were two different phenomena going on here. One is this sort of delusion of growth, and then at one point also the imbalance in who profited, I guess, from that growth.
I would not say it was a delusion of growth. Growth is expansion of activity, and that was happening. But it was a delusion of the stability of growth. The delusion was the idea that we had come as a result of better policy, which is what central bankers always like to tell themselves when things are going well, that we'd come into a world where the variability had gone way down, and we were now, this was again this notion of the great moderation, that we were in a world where economic growth would just continue on a much more stable path than had been true before. The reality was that what was happening to, in particular, inflation after 1980 was that first of all, the domestic forces which had been creating cost pressures, particularly wage the ability of workers to raise their wages. It disappeared in the recession of the early 1980s. And then internationally, commodity prices collapsed in the mid-1980s. And by the late part of the decade, you had a ceiling on the price of a lot of imported labor-intensive consumer goods, which were now coming in from China at very low and stable prices. So all of these things were meant that for international reasons, inflation was not going to come back no matter what central bankers did or didn't do.
So then we have in this period from 1980 up until the mid-2000s, we have these series of bubbles, and then the house of cards fell. Let's talk about what led to that 2008 crisis, and tell us a little bit about Hyman Minsky, who I don't think our audience would be terribly familiar with.
Yeah, well, first of all, a bubble has to be enabled, and then in the run up to the great financial debacle of 2007, there were a number of enabling factors. The first was the deregulation of the financial sector, the repeal of laws which had previously restricted its activities, including Glass-Steagall in 1999, and the passage of something called the Commodities Futures Modernization Act that was slipped in at the end of 2000 and made it just opened up the floodgates of the derivatives market. So you had these enabling conditions for a vast expansion of esoteric financial activity. And then you had the cops taken off the beat in the early 2000s, that is to say the FBI and the financial regulatory agencies basically were eviscerated on these questions. So people who wanted to play fast and loose with mortgages and with mortgage-backed securities were given basically a green light. They were told nobody's going to stand in your way, and off they went. And the market gets taken over by the most aggressive operators, all of whom later collapsed, whether you're talking about Ameriquest or Countrywide or WaMu or a whole rogues gallery of dreadful financial operations. So that then creates, to come back to Minsky, Hyman Minsky was an economist who understood very well how financial systems tend to become unstable over time, and that's basically because as you have a long run of relative success, investors like to do what is called reaching for yield. That is to say, they keep seeking to gain a little extra edge by taking a little more risk, by taking a more speculative position. Eventually, they get into a state where the only way they can refinance their positions by taking out new loans all the time. The only way they can meet their commitments is to add to their debt. And when you're in that position, you're clearly going to collapse sooner or later. And the household sector moved there quite decisively by the middle 2000s. But what I argue is that there is, in addition to Minsky's little dynamical picture, which is very interesting, another phase that happens once you're clearly in an unsustainable situation, and that is the corporate insiders have an overwhelming temptation to loot their institutions. And so you get a wave of what the criminologist Bill Black calls control fraud, fraud by the people who are in control of the company, who are basically enriching themselves in the full knowledge that when it's exposed, the company will collapse, and maybe they'll be prosecuted, and maybe they won't be. It turns out in the aftermath of this enormous debacle, very few people, in fact, practically no one has been prosecuted. And so we have an environment where big bankers understand that they are too big to be pursued by the Department of Justice.
It's fascinating. This week, of course, there was a report out, or I guess I should say some reporting in This American Life, where Carmen Segura, a former regulator with the Fed, who came in after the New York Fed, I should say, after in response in many respects to a report from a Columbia professor who was saying that there's a culture at the New York Fed which allowed the 2008 crisis, I guess, or the problems to metastasize and lead to the crisis. There was an interesting piece that Felix Salmon highlighted by Daniel Davies, saying that, you know, one aspect of it which really struck me was the New York Fed was tasked with the idea of making sure that these big banks were financially secure. And so rather than rein them in on issues that may be fraudulent or near fraudulent, if it made the money, that was basically the only litmus test. And that sort of, I guess, it reinforces your point, this notion that they were allowed to run amok, and amok they did.
Well, a sensible regulator will tell you that when a financial institution is growing very rapidly and appears to be making enormous amounts of money on some new invention, that's when you need to look at them. That's when you need to extend your scrutiny, because basically this is a very mature sector. Banks have been around an awfully long time. The economy does not have an enormous amount of, sort of, let's say, it doesn't go into enormously rapid growth spurts. It hasn't done so for a long time. So when some sector of the economy suddenly announces that they discovered, an alchemy that turns lead into gold, it's time to go and have a look at them. But the mentality you described leads you to precisely the opposite result. Oh, well, the markets are examining them. It must be fine. The CEOs and the CFOs are getting celebrated in the financial magazines. And the regulators basically look the other way. That is what happened repeatedly in the run-up to this crisis. And, of course, at some point it all falls apart and everybody's revealed to have been grossly negligent and foolish.
And so does 2008, I mean, moving on to, you know, and I know you perceive 2008 or this crisis or the period and sort of the wake of it as a turning point. What was 2008 is it in itself a turning point, or is it just that the party is over and we realize, we are. The party's over and the hangover is going to continue, or is it that it simply has basically lifted the veil and now we see the problems that we really have had for some time?
I'm in the second camp, and let me just clarify the sequence of things and ask and sort of stipulate what it is that I'm trying to draw a contrast with. If you look at the way economic forecasting is done, including by the government, by the Congressional Budget Office, Office of Management and Budget, and so forth. What they did in the wake of the debacle of 2008-2009 was to run their models on the assumption that we would return to the previous track of growth. And they created what they do, and this is not just now, but it's all every time there's a recession. What they do is they project the past forward and call that potential output, and then they have a track that usually runs over 5 years or so, during which the economy is going to recover and go back to that previous trend level of activity. And that depends, the whole exercise depends upon the future looking like the past. And in this case, we've now gone 6 years since they started doing this, 5-6 years since they started doing this. And, of course, we've never come back to the trends. And what they do is that every year they simply roll the base forward and say, okay, well, 5 years from now we'll get back there. And this is a kind of a mechanical false fool's optimism, if you like. It is basically part of a technocratic exercise, which strikes me as clearly invalidated by the experience since the crisis. Now, when was the turning point? I would argue that the actual turning point was not 2007, but 2000, basically at the turn of the millennium, the end of the information technology boom. That was the last really big business-based credit boom. And what was happening afterwards during the whole Bush administration was a whole sequence of things to kind of keep the party going. The tax cuts, I'm not going to say the wars were fought in order to boost the economy, but they did have that effect for a little while. There was a kind of a public spending boom in 2004. And all through this, they were encouraging financial institutions to put money into loans that they knew were not be repaid. And that's what fell apart. It was this kind of already the hangover or the after party was being run for 6 or 7 years, and that's what collapsed definitively in 2007 to 2009. And then we've been living with the consequences ever since.
And I should point out that in your I was struck in your piece in the Washington Monthly from 2009. Entitled "No Return to Normal," you made the point that the in terms of that sort of the GDP gap that the CBO had expected a turnaround, saying that by 2015 everything would return to normal with the economy, and you were skeptical at the time, and it. We're a couple months away from 2015, and I think that your skepticism obviously was justified.
Yeah, it was well founded. And the difference, the thing that I saw already in 2009, was that this was a very different kind of collapse. I've lived through a lot of recessions. Well, the big ones in my career were in the early 1980s, and what happened in those events was that you had basically an economy with a fair amount of momentum, in fact, to the taste of the Federal Reserve, too much momentum, and you got a restrictive policy that caused it to go into reverse for a while. And sometimes those shocks were external, sometimes internal, but they were temporary, and they were on the basis of an economy that still had a lot of, let's say, recuperative capacity. But this time, the entire financial sector imploded. It melted down before our eyes. And the structure was only held together by enormous trillion-dollar interventions, scores of trillions of dollars in the case of central bank lending. And it was clear that this was something that was outside of previous experience. And so already in March of 2009, which is only, what, 4, 5, 6 months at the most after the climax of the debacle in 2008, it seemed to me anybody with a kind of confidence in their eyes and ears, with a qualitative sense of what was going on, ought to have known that this was a different experience. But relying on statistical projections, which sort of discount any common sense observation, and basically policy was operating on the assumption that it was just another recession, and in fact language was created to give that impression. The thing was called the Great Recession, and I suppose the subconscious message there was that the Great Recession would be followed by a great recovery.
Right.
Well, guess what?
And before we get to the four horsemen of the end of growth, as you call them, but you also find that same sort of, I guess, sense that this is a great recession that is, you know, finite, and we're going to move into a period of recovery, even in the responses, not just of those economists on the right, but those presumptively on the left as well, that simply a fiscal stimulus of the proper size would return us back to normal.
Yeah, the difference between right and left within this kind of narrow framing of economists was between one side, which said, okay, we'll get back to normal without doing anything. And in some cases, they were saying, huh, the reason we didn't get back to normal is that we tried to do things. That was Alan Greenspan's position. I might call the crackpot counterattack in 2010. On the left, the idea was we can get back to normal, but we should help things along by giving the system stimulus. And stimulus is, it's an interesting word. It conveys... It's something you get from coffee or amphetamine. It is says you've got a basically healthy organism, and it just needs to be given some fuel or an extra burst of energy. And again, that strikes me as, I mean, the word is very much in common use. Everybody uses it, but it moves thought in the wrong direction, or in a direction that's profoundly misleading. If you look at a car whose transmission has melted down, you don't say, we just need to put gas in the tank or charge up the battery. You say, well, this vehicle's got a real problem, and if it can be repaired at all, that's going to be an expensive and time-consuming proposition. So again, being careful about your metaphors helps you think clearly about what's going on.
And so let's talk about those four horsemen, as you call them. Yep. The first is the choke chain effect, which essentially deals with the cost of resources.
Yes, and a big difference between the early post-war period and the period after 1970 was, up until 1970, we didn't have, economics basically ignored resources altogether. They were cheap, they were a small piece of GDP, and economists were trained to think of them as being an unimportant factor.
And people should note that we were the world's largest oil producer essentially up until that time.
That's right.
And so it was as if we were just consuming air.
That's exactly right. So this was all built into the DNA of growth models at the time, that these resource factors were unimportant. There was an effort to project them into the discussion in the 1970s. It was flawed in some ways. In any event, didn't succeed. By the 1980s, we were back to thinking in the same terms and continued to, I think, fool ourselves. Nobody, I think, today who has a serious grip on reality can deny the importance of resources. And two things happened in the 2000s. One is that the price went up so that we were paying about twice for basic energy than we were in the 1990s. And the other is that the whole sector became financialized, became subject to a lot of speculative pressure. And I do a lot of talking around here in Texas, so I was up in Oklahoma, talk to people who know this area. And when I start talking about this, you can see the heads moving in the audience as people say, oh, yes, so that's exactly what happens. What happens is that as prices go up, people hold inventory. They hold it in the ground, or they hold it in ships, or they hold it in holding tanks, thinking, well, gee, next month I can release the oil onto the market at a much higher price. And that price went up to $148 a barrel in the summer of 2008. And, of course, when that happens, it's going to collapse, and it did. But you have a real pressure on the purchasing power of consumers when they're paying very high prices for basic fuel. Okay, so that's part of it, and that I think everybody understands that this is really important. There's a big qualification right now, which is that, and something which really was not foreseen 5 years ago, and that's the effect of natural gas on the United States in particular, where we have a very large increase in the production of natural gas as a result of the innovation of fracking. The fact that we pay a lot lower price for that in this country than the Europeans pay when they buy it from the Russians, factor of four, makes a big difference in helping us have a more stable outcome than is presently true in either Europe or Japan. How long that will go on is another big uncertainty. But what is clear, and the point to be made about resources, is no economic modeling going forward should be taken seriously unless it takes account of both the cost of resources and how confident one is about the stability of supply and stability of price going forward.
And this is a bit of a digression, but you consider that one of the factors that has actually sort of that softened just how bad the 2008 crisis would have been.
There's no question. And yeah, we're having a certain rebound of manufacturing now because people around the world are bringing facilities to the United States to consume natural gas, electricity made from natural gas, and natural gas feedstocks. in manufacturing processes. So this is definitely helping us, and at the, not the Europeans, for example.
And we should also say the other thing that you attribute this to, I mean, I think you'd agree that the fiscal stimulus helped to a certain extent, but what really carried the day was things like automatic stabilizers, food stamps, and then other programs from the Great Society, Medicare, Social Security, those type of programs basically.
That was the other, great advantage that we have and have had over much of Europe, particularly Southern Europe, is that we have programs which kicked in very fast and buffered a lot of the loss of income of the bottom 60% of the American population. It's really quite remarkable when you look at the data how effectively things like Social Security and disability insurance and food stamps and unemployment insurance worked, at least for a while, at least initially. Those things are all under a lot of stress. Unemployment insurance, of course, you know, only lasted, extended unemployment insurance only lasted so long, but the there's a real difference between what happened here and what happened in, let's say, Greece or Spain or Portugal.
Now, what about? I mean, just I mean, I want to get back to those to the other three horsemen, but relative to Europe, how does that? How does the broader social safety net that exists in Europe differ from our, I guess, safety net or our automatic stabilizers? Is it that ours kick in at a time of crisis as opposed to pre-existing, or what is the difference there?
For the Southern European countries that were really plunged into the deepest crisis, the problem was that they were hit by austerity measures, which forced them to curtail their safety nets, which weren't terribly strong by European standards to begin with. So that, for example, in Greece, pensions were all cut dramatically to something like a maximum of 1,100 euro a month. So really, poverty level pensions, even for people whose incomes would have ordinarily given them much higher pensions. And so you have a situation where, and of course they pay a lot of consumption taxes and fuel taxes and so forth. So their incomes, their disposable incomes, got squeezed down to very tough levels. And that meant that the whole society came under enormous strain. And that's true across Southern Europe, and not so true in Germany or France, for example, but although France has gotten fair difficulties, but certainly true in the countries that were really hit hardest.
All right, so getting back to the other three horsemen of the end of growth, the next one is the futility of force or our military power in terms of having explain how that has sort of been missed in the context of this assumption that we're going to get back to the go-go days of growth.
Yeah, if this one is a little hard to quantify, but I would put it this way. If you look over the whole post-war period, in the Cold War, there was a kind of very stable structure which people got used to and came to expect, and the West, NATO, was a kind of, in the United States, were kind of guarantor of that stability, and you built up on that basis. After the Soviet Union collapsed, there was at least the idea that maybe we could have a stable world order with a single great power, a single superpower, the United States, that would be able to guarantee stability. Idea lasted for a while, but then in the 2000s, we made the foolish mistake of actually putting it to the test. Could we roll into Afghanistan and rescue that country? Could we roll into Iraq and create a stable democracy? And so our military power was put on display, and what emerged was a proof that military power in general is very limited. That you really can, in fact, resist it, that the result is not stability but chaos, which we're certainly observing in Iraq now. And I think that lesson has reached the whole world. And so they're asking themselves just how much stability can one expect going forward? And you can see all kinds of tensions all over the globe that I think are emerging as a result of this. So maybe the effect on us so far is not all that great, and there is, of course, still the Navy, which tends to be the only thing out there on the high seas, which is probably a good thing. But I think if you believe that the investment we made in global stability was worth something in the whole 50 years, then that investment's lost a lot of value.
I wonder, and let's talk about the essentially technology as well. I mean, I think that's...
Okay. Big issue.
Yeah. Yes. And that obviously impacts, it has replaced a lot of labor.
That's my view, and I think that's a common sense view. This issue is still quite controversial amongst economists. We were brought up as economists with a whole experience of the 20th century to say, well, you know, technology is always changing, but new technologies create as many jobs as they destroy. And I think if you look at, let's say, automotive technology, which requires roads and fuel systems and a vast maintenance sector, as well as the manufacture of vehicles, you know, well, you could say, well, yes, that did create a lot of employment. It wasn't so good for the horses that were replaced, but we forget about them. They're not in the statistics. Any event, jobs were created, and we had an economy that was based upon this particular technology. Now we have a new type of technology coming in, which is basically digital equipment, digitization, communications-based technology. It is solid state. A lot of the manufacturing is offshore. There's very little maintenance. Software is produced by small numbers of people distributed electronically. The infrastructure is pretty stable, doesn't wear out the way roads do. Fiber optic cable doesn't get potholes, for example. So you have a whole set of things which require much less labor. And my argument is that what happens, businesses basically go on and on their existing model until they have to change. So they don't tend to react to new technologies by always thinking about the best way to get rid of labor. But when they are hit by a big crisis, as they were 6 years ago, they lay off a lot of people. And then when they see some markets coming back, they ask themselves, what's the best way going forward? Do we hire people back, or is there a cheaper way of doing it? And the technologies keep thinking of new ways, or people who design these technologies keep coming up with new ways to expand their reach. And so you end up with applications all over the spectrum, from for that matter, college teaching to checkout clerks that have disappeared from drugstores, there where the technology is substituted for the labor. And that means, I think, that the private for-profit sector in particular is going to be hiring a lot fewer workers going forward. It's capital equipment is also much cheaper, but the main thing in effect on us is that this sector is not going to be bringing back all of the employment that was there 10, 15, 20 years ago.
And then you talk about the sort of the breakdown of the financial sector, and which, you know, we've talked about, and obviously that that gets into the broader issues of financialization. What now? Do you perceive climate change as being one of those things? I mean, when you talk about the futility of military power to create stabilization, there's sort of almost like a mirror force creating more destabilization, it seems to me, which would be climate change, which, you know, some suggest, you know, could have been at least a potential or a partial cause for the unrest in Syria, for instance, that you have these massive droughts that force people into the cities, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and it was certainly part of the troubles in Darfur a while ago that was water related. Climate change looms over us, and I think it looms over the world economy in important ways. But just to be clear analytically, and it's not to diminish the effects of climate change, its economic effects so far are relatively modest. And I think we will be seeing them more and more, but I didn't want to project something which is going to be much more serious in 30, 40, 50, and 100 years onto the present or the immediate past. I think and that's why I concentrated on these four other factors.
And let me just ask you about one more thing too that occurs to me when you talk about about technology and the company's reaction to whether or not they should rehire folks. Bill Lozonek from UMass has done some work on the productivity and wage gap that has taken place over the past 40 years or so, and tracks it with sort of CEO compensation tied to performance of stocks. And he sees this reflected in things like stock buybacks and whatnot. And it not only having the impact on creating wealth inequality, but also future prospects of corporations and growth. I mean, to what extent do you perceive that, or is that something that is you don't see that as terribly significant?
Well, Bill Lozonek's work in particular on the effect of corporate buybacks on stock prices is a very, very important contribution. What it shows is that, I mean, it's one thing that's happened in the last 6 years is you've had corporations taking advantage of very inexpensive funds, which they can borrow because of the climate of the monetary policy climate, and using it to reduce the supply of their shares on the open market, drive up the price. And that is very good if you are an executive whose compensation depends upon the share price. It's very good if you happen to be someone with a large portfolio of corporate equities. You watch the value go up as the supply diminishes. But it doesn't have anything in particular to do with the future prospects of that corporation. It's not a source of new investment. It's not a source of new employment. So it tells you something about what the stock market's run over the last 5 years really represented. And the disconnect is between that stock market run, which is very good for the incomes of people who own stocks, and the performance of the larger economy. So I think it's very valuable from that point of view.
And so let's talk about what presuming we've entered into this era of what is now the new normal, what is the answer for this? I mean, if we cannot count on the growth that we thought that we could, what should we anticipate, and what should our reaction be?
Okay, first of all, the new normal is Bill Gross's phrase, not mine. I tend to avoid it because I don't think we are going to adapt an attitude of this is what we should expect and be right. The real point of the end of normal is that we're in an era where we're much less sure of what's going to happen. Now, how do we react to that? I think the answer, the way you react to uncertainty, is by strengthening your protections, by strengthening your insurance. And the social insurance schemes, the bright spot in the picture, is that our social insurance schemes proved to be effective. They continue to work to a very large extent. They're under enormous stress and attack. They have historical enemies who go after them at every provocation and every opportunity. We need to push back very strongly. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, food stamps, deposit insurance. All of these things actually are the fabric that continues to, in some sense, hold our society together when it's under stress. They need to be strengthened, not weakened. A second big area, which is an enormously important buffer in the American economy and absorber of labor, is the nonprofit sector, under enormous stress. And the nonprofit sector does enormous numbers of things. It provides health care, provides education, particularly higher education. It provides a lot of caring functions, provides food. I have a colleague in North Carolina who's working on food pantries, and you know, what she finds is extraordinary. And this sector needs to be strengthened and built up so that it can withstand the stresses that a lower growth environment, more difficult environment, are going to put on it. And if we approach this with, from that point of view, it seems to me that we have a, at least a reasonable chance of having good and better lives for large parts of the population, in spite of the fact that the environment is going to be inherently more difficult.
James Galbraith, author of The End of Normal. We'll put a link to that on majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today.
Many thanks to you. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. We are going to now head into the funner half of the program. Remember, your support makes this show possible. Become a member today at majority.fm. In the funner half, we're going to take a deep dive, if that's possible, into Dr. Ben Carson. Perspective on history. This is coming out of the really, I don't want to say massive. I mean, we're seeing massive protests in Hong Kong right now. And apparently 10,000 people, 10,000 workers have gone on strike in support of the larger Occupy Central strikes that are going on in Hong Kong. But there have been very big protests in Colorado. A couple of schools, actually, a couple of school districts have had to shut down because of essentially sick outs by teachers and students, part of which is centered around a new curriculum in Colorado that's being proposed that will emphasize patriotism in AP history, because your AP history guys, they walk around. These girls and these guys, they walk around. They're so nerdy, but they're not American-loving enough. And that's really what we know is the point of history, is to create true patriots. Otherwise, why would you call it history? I have no idea what that means. We'll also be talking about Scotty B's. As you know, if you are a new listener to this program, any opportunity for Michael and I to do Massachusetts accents to annoy Matt in the office, we will take. And so, we have about 14 different Google alerts set on Scott Brown. Also, Larry Craig back in the news. Yes, wide stance. We will also be talking about this this incredible College Republican ad targeting young women, and they know what the ladies like. And this new report, which shows the efficacy of birth control in cutting down on teen pregnancy and teen abortions, and simply reinforces the notion of the value of the Affordable Care Act's provision in providing free birth control services and mechanisms. And also, we'll get into this Amtrak story that if Chris Christie is lucky, it will not dog him as much as it really should. Of course, also voting victory in North Carolina, all these things and more in what we call the funner half. Ladies and gentlemen, as a way of sweetening the pot to becoming a member. You should become a member to support the free show. But then what we do is we reward you, not just with things like, oh, hey, I'm helping to support something I like. That namby-pamby stuff, no. We give you the goods. This is America. So we're not selling feel goodness here. We give you 50 minutes more. Well, today actually it's going to be a little less because we went long. And I got to pre-tape another interview. But we give you something you can measure, something you can digitally or put into your digital pocket and digitally enrich yourself. So become a member today at majority.fm. The number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the program. Of course, you can IM us via AIM at Majority FM or via the app. The app, iOS 8 broke and breaks the Majority Report app. And we put in the fix. Kyle was on it quick. We put in the fix over a week and a half ago, I think. It should go live in the next couple of days. We're just waiting on Apple. I suspect they're pretty backed up. That iOS 8, man. Watch out. I wouldn't go there yet. I just went to iOS 7, like literally a month and a half ago. I'm what is known as a mid to late adopter. I'm a late early adopter. That's what I am.
It worked in your favor this time around.
Always does.
I agree. That's what I do too.
Always does.
Proceed.
Proceed with caution. All right, folks. See you in a moment.